Well, it's been a real pleasure to spend yesterday evening and today with you, and particularly thank those who asked questions. Some of the most helpful things for me over the last couple of years have been the questions that I get asked when I give talks, because they always force me to go away and rethink some of the things that I've argued and to think about them in different ways. I want to talk in the third talk. I want to, in some ways, give, I suppose, sort of reasons for hope, I guess. I joke with the students at Grove that my capstone humanities course, which is really a sort of Christianity and modern thought over the last 300 years, of course, it's sort of, I don't know, 38 lectures of bad news and then a final lecture of good news, though half of that is spent discussing the exam, so it's sort of half a lecture of good news. I want to try to offer some constructive proposals. Some of what I've said has sort of been covered in some of the questions that have been asked already. But I want to start by saying we live in a time where the temptation for Christians, I think, is to be very warlike. The very language of culture war speaks to this, but I want to remind us that our task is to be persuasive. We don't engage those with whom we disagree in order to beat those with whom we disagree. We as Christians should be engaging those with whom we disagree in order to persuade them that they are incorrect. I always start my courses, with talking about the assessment that will take place at some point in the course. And most of my courses, in fact all of them at the moment, require a paper. And I make the point to the students that agreeing with me is not a criterion of success in the paper. And I follow that up by saying, because I have no vested interest in holding an incorrect opinion on anything. And if you think I hold an incorrect opinion on something, then I think there's a certain moral obligation upon you to try to persuade me of a better way of thinking on the issue. So I'd say to the students, I won't take it personally if you disagree with me on anything in this course, but you've got to give me an argument. You've got to disagree with me in order to try to persuade me. And I think we need to remember that, just as a background to what I'm going to say right now. There are forces out there, some more evil than others. I think the way the trans issue, for example, is damaging childhood puts it right at the top of my list of moral crises facing the nation at the moment. There are other things that we disagree with that perhaps have less pressing social urgency. But on all of them, I want to suggest that our first priority as Christians is, in whatever circles of influence we operate in, to try to be persuasive. It's one of the reasons I don't do social media. I think social media is not a persuasive medium. I think it is a combative medium. There is a great article, you can find it at Humanum Review. It's a Catholic journal published by the John Paul II Institute of the Catholic University of America, written by a Catholic philosopher, D.C. Schindler. It's a short paper, but the title is Social Media is Hate Speech. And he makes a very interesting argument there that the very medium of social media inclines it towards the dehumanization of those who we are addressing through social media. I commend that article to you, and I think it's something to remember as Christians, that when we behave in any public setting, social media being perhaps only the most obvious today, we need to try to do so in a way that brings no shame on the gospel, no shame upon us. In my mind, I always have the thought, what would my sons think of me when they read this? Will they think I'm an immature idiot and be unable to connect what I've written here to the Father they know? As a matter of personal policy, I have not put anything on the internet, I think, since 2016. That has not been edited by at least one other person. I write for World and I write for First Things. I don't have my own website, and everything I write for them goes through an editing process to save me from myself as much as anything. and also to improve what I've written so I look better than I deserve. That's the other side of it. But that's my first point, that I think we need as Christians to resist the temptation to fight fire with fire. That is not our calling. That is not to say that we are not to be trenchant and clear on many of the key issues of our day. We are called to clarity, but we are not called to gratuitous offensiveness. There is a difference. And sadly, there are many Christians today who seem to conflate those two things. And they think that being rude about other people is actually a sign of fidelity. I don't believe that that is the case. Secondly, I want to just highlight a few things that I've not yet mentioned. A bit more bad news, if you like, before I get to the answer. In order, again, to get us to think more broadly. To realize that the problems in society don't just come down to identity politics. They can come down to the way we behave in our own personal interactions with people. The big pathology that I've argued is kind of new, is that we tend to think of ourselves, at least in the West now, as free-floating individuals, able to determine and define our own identities. That is how we intuitively think. We also, I think, have lost, even as Christians, a sense of the transcendent. What do I mean by that? How would I prove that? Well, I would go to the example I cited last night, Cologne Cathedral. How do I know that people in the Middle Ages thought about their world differently to the way we think about ours? Time. Time was thought of very differently. I mentioned Cologne Cathedral. They start building it in 1248. They suspend building in the 1560s because of the Reformation. They recommence building in the 19th century, finally completed in 1880. If you ever find yourself changing trains in Cologne, it is a short walk from the railway station, and if you've got a couple of hours, what a way to spend a couple of hours looking at what I think is the single greatest piece of Gothic architecture on the face of the planet, Cologne Cathedral. And I mentioned last night that nobody who started work on that building ever thought they would worship within it. And yet they still thought it was worth doing. Why? Well, in one thing, they were working for future generations. They didn't think of themselves as independent, free-floating individuals. They thought of themselves as part of an ongoing community to which they had obligations and upon which they were dependent. But secondly, I think they had such a great view of God that they wanted to do something for him that was so great and grand that no single generation could achieve it. It was worth doing because their vision of who God was so great. We need to recapture something of transcendence. There's a lot of talk these days about the world's disenchanted, we need to re-enchant it. I'm not so high on that language myself for various reasons. But I do think we need as Christians to recapture a sense of the transcendent. How do we do that? Primarily we do that through our worship, I think. Worship is that which gives us a taste of transcendence. Now, that is not a sneaky way of arguing for traditional worship over contemporary worship. Don't take it in that way at all. But it is to say, however we think about worship and however we put worship together, it has to be done in the context of the transcendent. Think about Paul. When Paul in 2 Corinthians talks about, he gives that litany of suffering, and then he says it's but a light momentary affliction compared to the eternal weight of glory that is to come. There's a man thinking transcendently. He's not actually saying that his suffering is trivial in itself. He suffered badly. He's saying it's trivial in comparison to eternity. He has a transcendent vision that makes his life bearable. And I think first and foremost, we need to recapture transcendence. Only when we have a sense of the transcendence will we be able to think about the things of this world in a correct and proportionate manner. It's also, I think I mentioned this last night. It also takes huge weight off our shoulders when we start to think about time in terms of the transcendent. Because it means we haven't got to do it all ourselves by next Wednesday. All we have to do is do what we're called to do here and now. I remember, again, you know, when I first held my granddaughter, the first thoughts were, you know, what a blessing. Second thought was, oh no, I've got to worry about the next 70 years now. You know, you worry about your kids, but now my kids have kids, so the period of time I'm worried about gets longer and longer. But in a sense, it shouldn't change my behavior in any way. In fact, it was almost a kind of motive. And that's why it's important to keep telling the story. That's why it's important that somebody speaks the truth. Because if nobody speaks the truth disappears. And that's why I said, you know, some of the interesting, if you get a chance to read stuff, I can't remember his first name, but Bender, B-E-N-D-A. He's actually a Catholic, but one of the great dissidents in the Czech Republic. Works by Bender. I think it's Night of the Watchman is a collection of his writings. You'll find those very interesting writings because here is a man, Christian man, writing in the deep darkness of communism, but keeping the story of hope and freedom and faith alive. And he actually did live to see it all fall apart. Same with Vaclav Havel. Havel's not a Christian. And I think in his private life was not a particularly admirable man in some ways. But his writings kept the story of hope and freedom alive. They're interesting for Christians to read as an example of what we should be doing here and now. Second thing I think we need to think about, and you might say, well, I came here to get answers on pronouns and things like that. Why is he talking about this? Second thing I think we need to remark on in our era is it is an era profoundly marked by lack of gratitude. The fate of the term privilege fascinates me. I had a very privileged upbringing. My mum and dad, it was a humble background, but my mum and dad stayed together and loved me. Not everybody can say that. I passed a test that got me into a relatively elite school and I got an elite education. That was a privilege. I passed my Cambridge entrance exam and I got into the University of Cambridge. My granny scrubbed floors. My granny scrubbed floors and I got into Cambridge. Wow. Wow. And I'm grateful for that privilege. I'm grateful for that privilege. Privilege has become a bad word. And there are certain privileges that are bad. But the problem is, we live in an age where nobody seems grateful for anything. Because all the bad stuff that happens to me is somebody else's fault. And that's a function of expressive individualism. We can trace that attitude back to Rousseau. We're to be grateful. Read the New Testament. Paul's writings are suffused with gratitude. Gratitude for the gospel. Gratitude even for some of the crummy churches he writes to, that he's having to take a big stick out and have a bash at. But he's still grateful for them. Gratitude is very important. I gave a lecture on gratitude in Dallas a while back. And somebody, you know, it was one of those things, you know, you get asked a question that really does challenge you. And you think, wow, I hadn't thought of that. And somebody said, I made the comment that my mum and dad brought me up that you say, when somebody does something to you, for you, you say thank you. And I made the comment that when I'm on a plane and the steward comes down giving out the cookies, or if it's American Airlines, pretzels. Whoever decided that plain pretzels are a good food, I don't know. They don't do it for me. Flavored ones are great, but... And I say, and if I'm sitting next to somebody and the person says, what would you like to drink? And they say, water. Without saying please, I said, I automatically despise them. My mum drilled it into me that you say please and you say thank you. You always express gratitude. And somebody asked me an interesting question afterwards. They said, why would you say thank you to somebody who's just doing their job? And I thought that was a really good question, actually. It's one thing for somebody to do something for you that is above and beyond. It's another thing for somebody to do something for you that they're kind of obliged by their work contract to do. And I wrestled with that for a couple of weeks, tossing around. I think that's a great question. And I came to the answer, this answer. In expressing gratitude to that person who's done that thing, I'm acknowledging their humanity as a person. I'm acknowledging their humanity as a person rather than just an instrument. When I say thank you to the steward or the stewardess who gives me my glass of water, I'm not merely treating them as a means to an end. Somebody who does their job like a robot would do the job because they're programmed to do it. I'm acknowledging them as a subject with free agency who's done something for me. Gratitude. If we want to restore what it means to be a human being, I think we need to think about gratitude. How we build gratitude into our relationships and our communities. I made a comment last night that I have rarely, if ever, criticized charismatic theology, and never, I think, gone after what I would regard as an orthodox charismatic for being a charismatic, because it was charismatics who told me about Jesus. And I'm grateful to them for that. It was not the confessional Presbyterians who told me the gospel. It was the crazy charismatics. And I'm very grateful for that. Gratitude, I think, is an extremely important thing that we need to cultivate within our Christian communities, because gratitude is one of the things that makes us human. Animals are not grateful to each other. Human beings are. There's an analog with love, of course. Why is married love, in some ways, so much greater than parental love? Well, there's that phrase, isn't there, we use, a face that only a mother could love. And, you know, it's great that mothers love us, but they're kind of obliged to do it. Yeah, that's the problem. You could be a real pain in the neck and your mother's still got to love you. To have another free individual love you when they don't have to, that's wonderful. And that is deeply humanizing. So we need to recover gratitude. We also, I think, need to recover, as Christians, the virtue of self-restraint. Self-restraint is something that has disappeared in our society precisely because of this normative notion of being an expressive individual. I find it very interesting that my experience these days, churches don't generally debate modesty anymore. When I became a Christian in the 80s, debates about modesty were commonplace in the churches I was involved in. They were very sexist debates, because by and large, debates about modesty were really debates about women's clothing. Bikinis versus one-piece bathing suits, length of skirt, etc., etc. I don't think I ever heard a modesty debate relative to male clothing. If I'd known about the existence of open-toe sandals and muscle shirts, I would probably have thrown those into the mix at that point just to balance the sex divide there. I mentioned muscle shirts because some of you listen to my podcast, Mortification of Spin. When we don't have guests, we record online. My co-host, Todd Pruitt, wears a muscle shirt. I'm there in my jacket and tie, whatever, and he's in a muscle shirt online. It's hard. That's all I can say. But think about the disappearance of modesty. Why has modesty disappeared as something debated in churches now? And the debates in the 80s took place. People agreed that modesty existed. The debates were not about whether modesty existed. They were where the limits should be set. We agree there's a concept called modesty. Now let's debate where we draw the lines. We don't debate modesty typically anymore, because modesty as a concept has virtually vanished from our culture. It's not an issue anymore. Because for one person to say to another person, I think that's an inappropriate way of dressing, is to oppress them. Very hard for somebody from my background to get my head around that. I went to a school with a uniform. And the reason we had a uniform was we weren't individuals. And we were actually called by, the teachers called us by our surnames, not by our Christian names. As another way of making us clear that you're not really important as an individual. You're just a representative of family. We need to recapture self-restraint online and elsewhere in the Christian world, because self-restraint is a way of respecting the humanity of other people. I mentioned we need to recapture community. This, I think, is the whole question of community is interesting. I mentioned in the Q&A the qualification of hospitality among elders. It's a very important qualification, I think. Secondly, I think when we look at what's happening to the church, it seems to me inevitable that the church is going to be, is being, and will continue to be, increasingly marginalized in coming years. The days when Meet the Press would have a Father Richard John Newhouse on to discuss the week's papers, those are gone. I think even the Catholic Church is now being shunted to the sides. And that can be a source of understandable anger and frustration when you're at the center of a culture and suddenly you're shunted to the margins rather rapidly. That's a painful thing to experience. But I think it would be a tragedy if we saw that only as a setback and not as an opportunity. One of the things I loved about the old America, the one that I emigrated to, that has sort of seemed to have disappeared somewhat over the last 20 years, was we'd watch these news reports of people whose houses had been swept away by floods or something. And they'd be interviewed on the news, and they'd say things like, well, we built it from the ground up before, I guess we just got to do it again. And it was a sort of, okay, these people have had everything taken from them, but they're not sitting around feeling sorry for themselves. They're just getting on with it. I think as we are marginalized as a church, one of the things that marginalization provides tremendous opportunity for is strong community. Strong community. Going back to my previous life as a Reformation historian, one of the sort of the influential sociological theses put forward by Max Weber is that there is a sort of an affinity between the rise of capitalism and the spirit, and Protestantism. Protestant theology fosters a mindset that fuels capitalism. It's been very influential. I think it's a little more complicated than that, though. Because if you look at the English Industrial Revolution, many of the great names of the English Industrial Revolution, were Quakers. Quakers. You think, why Quakers? Well, prior to the Reform Acts in the United Kingdom in the 19th century, if you were a nonconformist, if you were not an Anglican, you couldn't go to university. You couldn't be a civil servant. You certainly couldn't vote. You couldn't serve as an MP. You couldn't do anything, really, other than make stuff. A lot of the great capitalists in 19th century England were Protestant nonconformists. And I don't think it was their Protestantism that was the sole key to understanding their success. It was also the fact that they were marginal, strong communities who worked together to do the one thing they could do. Think of the Jews. The House of Rothschild, for example. Why are the Jews such successful bankers? Nothing to do with international conspiracies. And everything to do with the fact that that's pretty much the only thing that they were allowed to do in Europe in the Middle Ages. They were a persecuted, marginal group. It's funny, when I spoke at the Muslim college in California, in Berkeley, right opposite UC Berkeley, and a friend said, what did you feel like? And I said, I got a little taste of what it must have been like to be Jewish in medieval Europe. And he said, what do you mean? And I said, safest place for me in Berkeley is the Muslim enclave. Yeah, they surrounded me and protected me. Marginality is not something we should rejoice in, but is not something we should squander either. I think we need to realize this is a tremendous opportunity. Some say to me, well, you're very defeatist, aren't you? You seem to be saying that we need to regroup and just become strong communities. Not sure that's defeatism. It's only defeatism if you don't get the message of Cologne Cathedral. It wasn't defeatist for the Christians to do that at the end of the first, beginning of the second century. even though their triumph wouldn't come until the 4th century. I think it's actually being a faithful Christian, to be a faithful Christian community. I think we need to cultivate friendship. We need to cultivate friendship. Why do I say that? Well, I think part of the problem we face on the sexual revolution front is that we have lost the concept of friendship. I was talking to a youth worker within the last year or so who works on, I think he's works for, can't remember the name of the group, Young Life, in one of the public schools in the Western Pennsylvania area. And he said to me, do you know that, I think he said 80% of 14-year-old girls at the school identify as lesbians. And I said to him, wow, that's way out of proportion to what we'd expect from national statistics. What do you think's going on? And he sort of said two things. He said, one, it isn't cool to be straight anymore. So there's that kind of, if you're straight, you're just not cool. But he also said this. He said, they have no concept of what friendship is. They have strong feelings for somebody of the same sex, and the only vocabulary we give them to understand that is a sexual vocabulary. We have lost friendship. What do we need to do in our churches? Model friendships. Interesting, you read one of my sort of guilty pleasures, he shouldn't be a hero of mine, but he kind of is. John Henry Newman, 19th century Anglican, convert to Roman Catholicism. When you read some of his letters to male friends he has, from today's perspective, they sound homoerotic. From a Victorian perspective, they're nondescript. Because weirdly, although English men were very, very buttoned up in the Victorian era, of which I sort of lived at the very end of culturally, I suppose, they spoke to each other in very passionate ways in the letters they wrote. Weird. We now read those letters through the highly sexualized lens of the beginning of the 21st century. But they were not that way. In the 19th century, they were witnesses to the depth and the passion that could mark male friendships. We need, I think, to recover friendship. We need to recover, or even gain, perhaps for the first time, the importance of the body. Particularly, one might say, the sexed nature of the body. Why do I say that? Well, various reasons I've already outlined, but I think one of the things that bodies do is they remind us that persons are not abstractions. I'll give you a couple of examples, one of which will probably grate with many of us here because they're being used by the other side in the culture wars at the moment. Think about the overthrow of Roe v. Wade in the wake of the Dobbs decision. What did the pro-abortion lobby immediately pivot to? The language about, well, the baby's just part of the woman's body became a little bit more muted. And the things that grabbed the headlines were the little girl in Mississippi who'd been raped and got pregnant and couldn't have an abortion. Now that's powerful. That's powerful. Even as a pro-life person, I hear that story and it's just breaking your heart. Why does it break your heart? Because a little girl in Mississippi who's been raped is not an abstraction. She's a person. She's a human being. One of the things we have to do, I think, in church and in Christian circles is to regain the importance of bodies because bodies remind us that persons are not abstractions. I use the example, an example in class of another thought experiment. We can imagine a scenario where Professor Robert George, the great pro-life Catholic thinker at Princeton University, and Professor Peter Singer, the professor of ethics at Princeton University and a great advocate for infanticide and euthanasia, are walking down Nassau Street together late one night, and they hear a baby crying in a doorway, and they go over to see what's going on in the doorway, and lo and behold, they see a little baby in a basket there. We all know that there is no disagreement between Peter Singer and Robert George about what to do in that situation. It's not that Robert George is going to say, we need a call for help for the whoever just gave birth to this baby and for this little child. We need to get them to safety straight away. And Peter Singer says, no, no, no. Child is not a person until they're 2 years old. We can leave them here for the feral cats and dogs to eat. That's not the conversation. Peter Singer's already dialing 911 even before Robert George has got the sentence out of his mouth. Why? Because the baby is not an abstraction. The body is not an abstraction. Embodied personhood is not an abstraction. And interestingly enough, Peter Singer's own life gives witness to that. Big advocate for euthanasia. If you've got Alzheimer's, latter stages of Alzheimer's, you're no longer a person. There is nothing immoral in having you put to death at that point. His own mother had Alzheimer's or the equivalent thereof, and he cared for her. And I read an interview online where he's asked by the interviewer, you cared for your senile mother, isn't that a little inconsistent with your philosophy? And Singer gives this sort of naive but such an eloquent in terms of what's going on answer. He says, yes, I suppose it is, but I guess it's different when it's your own mother. Yeah, it's absolutely different because your mother is not an abstraction. She fed you at her breast. She bounced you on her knee. She put sticking plaster on your knee when you came home, having grazed it on the way back from school. She's a person. So we need to regain the idea of persons in the way we think. Arguments are rooted in abstractions. Imaginations are gripped by concrete realities. And we need to think both in the way we present our arguments in public and the way we think in church of people as human beings and not as abstractions. We also need to realize that despite the great myths of the body not being important, the body remains ineradicably important. Some of you have asked questions privately and that about, so what should apologetic strategy be in this situation? Well, I would say one way to approach the modern world is this and say, the myth of the modern world, one myth of the modern world is articulated beautifully by Rousseau, a man is born free and everywhere is in chains. That sums expressive individualism up in some ways or some important aspects of it. Self-evidently not true. Of all creatures on the face of the planet, man is born remarkably dependent. My granddaughter, sorry to keep bringing her up, but I'm kind of proud of her, like to talk about her. My granddaughter is nearly 2 years old. She's 19 months old, I think. She's still utterly dependent upon her parents. Were she a hamster, she would have little hamsters of her own by now. I used to breed hamsters as a youngster. Kind of obnoxious habit, I suppose. It's an interesting thing about hamsters. A couple of interesting things. One, you have to be very careful. They're very egregious creatures. If you breed hamsters, you have to separate them at 21 days because they'll attack and kill each other. They live alone. They get together to mate, and that's pretty risky for the male because if the female isn't ready, she will try to castrate the male. And if she is ready, she will try to castrate the male as soon as it's all over. It's a risky business. Hamsters are born free and remain free. Human beings are born in relation of utter dependency. If you start with a wrong understanding of what it means to be a human being, the expressive individual understanding of what it means to be a human being, you will never get things right. Human beings are creatures marked at every stage in their life by dependency and obligation. I'm in my, getting towards my late 50s now, mid-50s, heading to late 50s. I was at one time very dependent upon my parents. Then I had people dependent upon me. And now I'm at that tipping point where I'm guessing in the next 10, 15 years, I am going to become dependent once again upon others. But at no point have I been free. At no point have I been free. And those who try to live their lives as free-floating individuals ends up as pretty disastrous. There's a reason why the New York Times never profiles 80-year-old swingers. Because they're old, broken, and pathetic. Hugh Hefner, Case in point. Expressive individualism works wonderfully when you're in your 20s, 30s, maybe on into your 40s. It's a disaster. It's a disaster when you're older. Dying old and alone if you follow the philosophy consistently. We know intuitively that we are creatures of dependency and obligation. Why? Because we are bodies. Why am I about to become dependent in the next 15, 20 years? Because my body's getting old and will ultimately give out on me. Why is my granddaughter dependent upon my son and daughter-in-law? Because of her tiny little body that is not able to look after itself. We need to rethink the importance of embodiment. We also, I think, need to acknowledge that sex, correct sexual ethics, have a shape and a significance to them. How might I demonstrate this? I've got a good friend, Frank Beckwith. He teaches law at Baylor University. Wrote what I consider to be an amazing essay on the sacred nature of sex a few years ago. And he uses Harvey Weinstein as his thought experiment. He says, imagine this. Imagine if Harvey Weinstein had been coercing young women to cook him meals so that his wife didn't have to wear herself out cooking meals so that he could make love to her in the evening. He said, we'd think that that was a kind of immoral situation because he's forcing these girls to do something they don't want to do for his sexual satisfaction. But, he says, we don't think of him in quite the monstrous way we do. He takes the thought experiment to the next level and he says, well, what maybe the comeback then from a student might be, yes, but what Harvey Weinstein was doing involved an invasion of the body. An invasion of the body. So Frank says, okay, second thought experiment. Harvey Weinstein is insisting that these young women who want parts in his movies allow him to lick his finger and stick it in their ear as the price they pay for getting into his movies. We would regard Harvey Weinstein as a bit of a creep. So Frank then raises the question, so why do we regard the fact that he invaded the bodies of these young women in a particular way as particularly heinous? And Frank's point is because the sex nature of bodies and the sexual act itself have intrinsic significance. It is not social construction. It's not just the fact that these are bodily actions. I say to the students, but rather bluntly, if somebody slaps me in the face, I'll be hurt by that, physically hurt, but 6 weeks from now, I'll probably be laughing about it. If somebody sexually assaults me, I'm probably damaged for the rest of my life because something of deep significance has gone on there that doesn't really have an analog with other forms of physical assault. And praise God that even in our own world of the sexual revolution, the law still recognizes that. We treat rapists far more seriously than we treat people going around licking their fingers and sticking them in people's ears. We have, if you like, a folk memory or an intuition that that is the case. So we need to bring the body back into Christian teaching. How do we combat so much of what's going on today? Well, I said earlier, and it was a sort of almost a trite, glib kind of thing, we need to teach the whole counsel of God. But above all, as we teach the whole counsel of God today, we need to teach a good doctrine of creation that takes human embodiment seriously. We do not know what challenge the culture is going to throw up next. But it seems to me that the last 300 or 400 years have involved an increasing assault upon the body. The body has become less and less and less important for who we really are. We need to counter that by asserting the personal importance of the body so that whatever the next stage in this fight is, we're prepared for it. Finally, What else do we need to do in the church? I think we need to teach on suffering. One of the big shifts that I've seen, I've not seen it myself, but I've observed that it must have happened. It's interesting to me that churches are no longer built with graveyards by them. Now, there are various reasons for that, zoning reasons, etc., etc. Whatever the reasons for that, there is an effect of that. We no longer worship in the vicinity of the dead, which was a hallowed Christian tradition right from the early church up to the relatively recent times. I've often wondered, what would it be like to go to worship as John Owen, walking past the graves of your 11 children every Sunday? Some of you perhaps have loved ones who are buried, and you go and visit the grave maybe once a year, or you know, on special days such as birthdays, etc., etc. What would it be like to walk past that reminder, that presence of your dead loved one every Sunday as you go to worship? I think it would shape how you think about worship. It would make the Anglican liturgy relative to funerals about the shortness of life and the suffering contained therein that much more plausible. I think one of the things we need to do is to bring mortality and suffering back into regular Christian teaching. Mortality, because it's going to meet us all at some point, and suffering because it might meet us sooner than our mortality. I said earlier that I think sessions set the cultural tone for congregations. And I think what is preached and what is sung sets the horizon of expectation for the Christian life of the people in the church. Doesn't mean that we go to church to be made miserable, but it does mean that we should go to church to be taught that there is a transcendent dimension which is not unconnected to the inevitable suffering and mortality that comes to us in this mortal coil. Not sure if that's ending on a note of hope or not, but those are my positive suggestions for how church culture might be changed. We need to think of transcendently. We need to cultivate the virtue of gratitude, the virtue of community. We need to see marginalization as giving us opportunities, even as we lament its occurrence. And we need to think about how the body should shape how we think of ourselves and how we think about other people. Thank you for listening so patiently.